Chapter 15, The Garden of Gethsemane. The Garden of Gethsemane is only a short walk from St. Stephen's, or the Lion's Gate of the Old City. As you come out of the gate, you can see the garden across the valley of the brook Kidron. The Jericho Road winds down the eastern side of the city, through the valley, and up over the Judean hills towards the Dead Sea. One beautiful morning in November, I walked down the hill from the gate and along the road for a short distance. The air was as clear as the water of a mountain spring, and the sun warmed the stones of the walls and pavements. Three small boys were sitting on one of the walls overlooking the deepest part of the valley, and one of them was playing a harmonica. Two other boys came by with a flock of black and white goats. There were two newborn kids in the flock, tripping along on tiny black rubber hooves. I felt embraced by the light, the warmth, and the peace of the place. The garden itself had become a favorite place to me, and each time I had walked beneath the old olive trees with their silvery, gray-green leaves, I had been awed by the realization that the Lord Jesus himself had perhaps walked beneath some of these same trees, had touched their ropey, thick trunks, or leaned his shoulders against them. I had found this, each time, a more moving experience than I was prepared for. I had been taught to attach little value to places and visible objects. God was wherever we might seek him, and could be reached at any time. There was the danger of idolatry in the reverence for places and things, but I found myself now standing on a hillside he had known, looking across the dry valley whose shape cannot have changed very much toward the city of Jerusalem. In his time, too, it was a collection of domes and cubes with walls and towers very much like what I saw. This was the city he had loved and wept over. And as I looked at it, I had no arguments about idolatry. There is no escaping the power of visual and physical contact, for we are physical beings. I was silenced. This gave me an appreciation of the incarnation that I had never before had. The God of the universe had chosen this land, which men have called holy ever since, in which to become a man and to live and walk with ordinary men. There was something about this quiet garden, halfway, perhaps, between the crowded streets of the city and the home of his friends in Bethany, where he loved to go, which drew him. He had no doubt rested here often, had slept here, had spent long times in prayer, and had, on the last night before his death, struggled with the fear of death and with the will of his Father, which proved in the end to be inexorable. On this lovely morning, instead of going again up the hill and through the gate into the garden, I sat on a stone wall on the opposite side of the road and looked across toward the great masses of bougainvillea, the dark olive trees behind, and the Church of All Nations, or Basilica of the Agony, as it is also called. Over the door of the church is the Latin inscription, Sustinete hic et vigilate mecum. Wait here and watch with me. Of all the people who had known Jesus and listened to his teaching and followed him, there were a few whom he asked to accompany him after supper to his usual place, as Luke calls it, the hillside garden which they all knew so well. Judas, too, we are told, knew the place, for Jesus often met his disciples there. Yet Jesus did not seek some hidden spot where Judas would not so easily find him. Jesus then chose three disciples, Peter, James, and John, who were probably his closest friends and, according to Mark's account, began to be horror-stricken and desperately depressed. But there was one thing he asked of them, only that they should wait for him and keep watch. Then he left them alone, and he went by himself to pray. It was not easy to reconstruct the scene, sitting there on the stone wall. It was not dark and silent and lonely. The sun shone brilliantly on the soft stone of the city walls above me. There was plenty of noise, the grinding of the buses as they shifted gears for the hills on each side of me, the honking of taxis, the bleat of goats. There were people in the cars which sped by, people coming and going on the road and on the paths which traversed the valley, some workmen on the roof of a nearby convent. Who of us, I thought, might have been willing to do that favor for Jesus if we had been asked? I suppose, like Peter, we would have said without hesitation, "I am ready to go to prison or even to die with you." A shiny new bus with windows all the way around and windows in the roof drew to a stop across the street. Out of it came dozens of young people, teenage Israelis wearing the blue and white caps which are so popular among the kibbutzniks, members of collective farms. Everywhere I had gone, I met with such groups. Whether they have always had the same passion for touring or whether they are gorging themselves with sightseeing since the war gave them so much new territory, I do not know. But there they always were, in the churches, at the Dome of the Rock, at Solomon's Pools near Bethlehem, in the bazaars, shouting, singing, "Jerusalem of gold," waving their blue and white flags. They poured out of the bus and shouldered their way hurriedly along the sidewalk, laughing and calling to one another. I watched them, wondering if it was to the Garden of Gethsemane that they had come. They passed the Basilica of the Agony without so much as a sideways glance, and they did not turn up the hill toward the entrance to the garden. They stayed on the sidewalk until they reached the Galed, the Mound of Witness, where a young medical student was killed on June 6, 1967, while fighting for the Holy City. It was this that detained them, a pile of rocks with some dried handfuls of leaves and flowers laid on it, some twisted pieces of metal and charred wood sticking out of the top, and some Hebrew words on a plaque commemorating an Israeli like themselves who had given his life for the Jewish state. The kibbutzniks paused there for a short time in silence, then turned around and piled back into their bus, which drove away. Almost at once, another bus came, full this time of foreign tourists. Jewish ones, I saw, for most of the men wore skull caps, with cameras and airline satchels. Their guide stopped them outside the wall of the garden and gave a brief speech. I wished I could have understood Hebrew. Then they, too, walked as far as the Galed, came back, boarded their bus, and went away. There is, besides the Latin inscription on the church, a beautiful mosaic showing on the left side a man holding a tablet with "Ignoratio." I do not know him. A man weeping, another with a sword, and a fourth kneeling with a crown. In the center panel stands Jesus alone, and on the right panel are women, a Pietà, others weeping and worshiping. Above the picture are two Greek letters, Alpha and Omega, God the beginning, God the ending. There, for me, was the clue to the meaning of life. The life of Christ on earth was a revelation of what this God, this Alpha and Omega, is like. It was an old Hebrew priest named Zechariah who saw the redemption of Jerusalem not as a military conquest at all, but as Christ himself. He knew the books of Isaiah, which told of the glory, beauty, majesty, and power of this redemption. The former oppression of Israel would be ended, peace and salvation published, and it would be said to Zion, "Thy God reigneth." The Lord hath comforted his people. He hath redeemed Jerusalem. How many times since Isaiah wrote those words has it seemed that Jerusalem has at least been freed, cleansed, redeemed? One who watched the exuberance of the young Israelis in 1967 could not miss the feeling that it had happened for them, at last. Yet, to read on in the same chapter of Isaiah's prophecy is to find that the servant whom God will send to accomplish his redemption is not pictured with glory, majesty, beauty, and power. He is the man who sweated in this garden. Quote, his visage was so marred, more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. The next chapter speaks of rejection, sorrow, contempt. This man was smitten, afflicted, wounded, bruised, chastised, beaten, oppressed, and finally slaughtered. The city of gold was behind me as I sat there on the wall. The garden that had seen God suffer was in front of me, and between the two went the buses, the donkeys, the Jewish tourists, the Arab farmers, the goat and sheep. Yes, sheep bleating, jostling one another, following a shepherd boy, and there were lambs among them too. It was to this city, the symbol of the world's hope, that the Lamb of God was taken from this dark garden to be slaughtered. It was this city that through the ages has been the scene of sorrow and destruction, a furnace of hatred and conflict. It was a furnace, all right, a blazing, seething, roaring place if you looked at certain aspects, and there seemed no prospect of ever quenching the fires. As one journalist said of Israel's unilateral annexation of Jerusalem, quote, it plants depth charges which will be exploding for the next 100 years. Things seemed peaceful and orderly enough on the Jericho Road this morning, but I had experienced several times during my stay in the city a certain quick fear. What if I could not get out of here? I found that my mail was being censored. Friends in the States wrote that some of my letters had arrived with a censor stamp or seal, and more than a dozen pages of notes which I had enclosed with my letters were missing from the envelopes when the letters arrived. I received a few letters myself from the outside, which had been opened and pasted shut again, or which had the corner cut off of the envelope. I began to toy with the idea of leaving when I heard of heavy firing across the Jordan, and when the Eilat, Israel's only destroyer, was sunk by the Egyptians. Things were likely to explode at any moment, it seemed. One lady tourist arrived at my hotel alone because the 9 others with whom she was touring the world had all canceled their visit to Jerusalem. It was just too hot a place to venture into. But I was fairly sure that I was safe and could get out when I wanted to. Anyway, the country was not mine. Its sorrows were not mine, and therefore were quite literally unbearable for me. One's own sorrows are always, and this is the worst of it, bearable. Every day I saw and talked with people who were bearing things I could not imagine enduring, and I wanted to ask, how can you do it? But they would have not known how to answer. It is the one who carries the load who knows its weight. Others look at him and say, how does he do it? And the thought of doing it makes them tired, but they do not really know what it is. Only one man knew. He was the one who bore our griefs and carried our sorrows. A party of American Negroes came into the garden, and 2 of the women posed against an olive tree, feet turned carefully to the proper angle, chins tilted toward the sun, while a man took their picture. A monk was walking slowly through the paths, his hands behind his back. Ordinary mortals, all of them, weak and guilty, yet very likely people with an earnest, honest desire to do right so long as it did not cost too much. There were all sorts of people in Jerusalem wanting to help. Red Cross people, UNRWA people, missionaries of many denominations, members of Jewish charities, members of Muslim charities, all tearing their hair and racking their brains in a desperate attempt to put out the fires, heal the wounds, make peace. Memories of these people crowded into my head as I sat near the garden. I had met so many of them, so many varieties. Two Muslim women who showed me through their prenatal clinic and kindergarten and food kitchens. A sweet little old lady from Canada who is cooking food for 50 Arab children on her own kitchen stove and had, with a cat as her only companion, lived through an incredible story of bombing in the Six-Day War. A young Christian from California who had come to help Israel. He wanted, in fact, to become an Israeli because, he said, I think Israel is the hope of the world and I want to be part of it. But, he added, I want to join the army as soon as they'll let me in. Who wants to be around here without a gun when those Arabs come in? A Scottish-Irish nun whose vocation was to serve the Jewish people, who said to me, I believe that I am faithful to my calling, but my heart bleeds every day for the Arabs. I had heard also the story of an Arab woman frantically searching for food to buy in the days following the war. A Jewish lady learned of her need and brought her bread, milk, and potatoes from her own home, and then invited the Arab lady to come back in 2 days for more. But none of the people who came and went in the garden, and none of the disciples who had found Jesus' simple request more than they could grant, was beyond the need of redemption. There was a thing that made Jerusalem what it was. The thing that brought many people to it was their longing for redemption. The thing that made of the place a furnace was the need of redemption. It seemed plain to me now as I looked at the inscriptions. Alpha and Omega. The God who started the whole thing could bring it ultimately to fulfillment. If ever there was such a thing as salvation, it was meant precisely for this world, for us men. Wait here and watch. The Son of Man still asks this of us, I believe, and some do not hear at all. Some answer quickly, yes, certainly, Lord, and come to the garden to worship, to build a church, to hallow the scene. Some saunter past, unaware that anything at all had happened here which could possibly concern them. Some see the horror on Jesus' face, hear the cry, witness the drop of blood and sweat, and then fall asleep. There is not one who understands, who is strong and holy. Yet it is these ordinary mortals whom the Son of God wanted by his side. I turned and looked across the valley and up to the Temple Mount where the golden dome rose beyond the sealed golden gate. Solomon's question came to me. Will God dwell indeed with man on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain thee, how much less this house which I have built. Hear thou from heaven thy dwelling place, and forgive and render to each whose heart thou knowest, according to all his ways. For thou only, knowest the hearts of the children of men. What had happened in Gethsemane was enough of an answer to Solomon's question. God would indeed not only dwell with men on the earth, he would become a man, would suffer for and with men and be captured by them. And it seemed reasonable to me to believe that such a God, thoroughly understanding the truth about every man, was watching this furnace carefully, and knew what he was going to do.